From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. One of the state's top-tier universities is calling this a moment for celebration.
Michigan State University just successfully landed its 25th head football coach.
But the process that got us here? Messy at best. Today on the show, we'll have more on the hiring of Mel Tucker, his $30 million compensation package, and the processes governing sports hiring cycles at Michigan's Big Three schools.
This cycle is called an arms race, and there's no end to it. Because it's not based on marketplace, it's based on the alumni enthusiasm for winning, which has no limitation.
Also, two working artists in Detroit talk about finding a canvas big enough to tell real stories.
If I could paint massively, how I paint, which is a fine art type way of painting, for the world to see, like, I control the narrative. I control our narratives.
Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. On the show today, we met up with a couple of contemporary artists in Detroit this week to talk about portraiture and celebrating the Black experience. We love their work and what they had to say. We know that you will, too. But before we get to that, Michigan State football fans are breathing a huge sigh of relief today as MSU makes its hire for a head coach, Mel Tucker, to lead its football program. Tucker has ties to Michigan State from when he was on Nick Saban's staff 2 decades ago. Given the abrupt nature of head coach Mark D'Antonio's departure earlier this month, a lot of people see Tucker as the best option. But the hire was expensive, and the circumstances surrounding it exposed some serious fractures in the college sports world, possibly also for Michigan's higher ed landscape. We invited author and sports commentator John U. Bacon to talk to us about it. John, welcome.
Thank you, April.
So regardless of what we may have learned about Michigan State University today and their hire of Mel Tucker, is there anything that this moment says to us about the NCAA and college athletics?
College football itself, it's even more insane than I thought. How's that? And I did not think too highly of it 2 days ago.
The fact that they would go all in for someone who had already turned them down once and who they didn't really have a strong, shall we say, courting relationship with.
There's no relationship here prior, basically.
Right.
Other than he was at Michigan State 20 years ago under Nick Saban, now at Alabama, who was at Michigan State. And Saban apparently pitched very hard for Mel Tucker, who's now at Colorado, or was at Colorado, for this job. So it's a pretty thin thread, to say the least. He did not want the job. He said no already. In his first and only season as a head coach at Colorado, which is not that great a football school right now and not that great a football conference, he went 5-7. That's not good. And they paid him $5.5 million. Worth noting, April, because you pay a man $5.5 million does not automatically make him worth $5.5 million. It's very hard to say that and say you can't pay players in the same breath.
Have hires been made on shakier relationships?
Yeah, but not very often.
Okay.
And the reason is this. Bill Beekman is the current AD at Michigan State. He is uniquely unqualified for this job. He ran the Alumni Association. He was the secretary for the Board of Trustees. Zero experience in athletics. He's not got a Rolodex. Look that up, kids. Doesn't know coaches. Coaches don't know him. He has no relationships with anybody out there, basically. Where Mark Hollis, the previous AD, had tons of these, of course. So he had to scramble, he panicked, and they backed up the Brinks truck, and that's what you get.
On Tuesday, the president of the NCAA, Mark Emmert, was in front of Congress urging America's lawmakers to put restrictions on whether college athletes can earn money from endorsements.
Mm-hmm.
The schools just can't pay this kind of money, he says. And here we are with Michigan State paying $30 million for a coach.
The timing is not good for that. I would say that Emmert's case is undermined by Michigan State in this case. Also, what Emmert conveniently elided in this case is that the name, image, likeness ruling passed by the NCAA at gunpoint, basically, they're forced to do it. The money does not come from the universities. That's a crucial distinction. Otherwise, Title IX gets engaged and other things change accordingly and should. If Coca-Cola wants to pay an athlete $1 million, that is not coming out of Michigan State's pocket. So I don't even know what he's talking about at this point.
But, I mean, could we even just, as you say, complete the elision and say that boosters don't have enough money to pay athletes? Would it be better if we just made a clean breast of this whole situation?
It'd be a lot of things would be better.
Yeah.
How about that? Look, the fundamental thing to me is that in basketball and football, they're the only sports in the world that do not have paid minor leagues to get to the pros. Baseball and hockey have those, so we don't have those problems in baseball and hockey. So if you're a hotshot 18-year-old, you have to go play college basketball or football to get to the next level. That's crazy. You get a lot of guys who don't want to be students, who shouldn't be students, who want to get paid, doing things they don't want to do. So as long as that is the equation and the NCAA's got a monopoly over those guys, any solution is going to be pretty weird.
I've just got to wonder at this point if the former MSU head coach, recently departed, Mark D'Antonio, really hates the school, really secretly hates the school.
You know what? It is now a fair question. For all his talk of loyalty, for all that he did for Michigan State in terms of getting the football program back to the top 10 and so on, man, he's leaving the cupboard bare for the next guy. He took a $4.3 million quote-unquote loyalty bonus and then quit like 2 weeks later, so there's your loyalty. And his timing could not have been worse. This is the end after the musical chairs ends every year. It's the day before the recruiting season ends. He put them in a truly horrible situation, and this is what they had to do.
If we could just drill back down to the conference for a moment. I mean, there's a huge, huge imbalance with Ohio State able to spend the kind of money that every other school would like to spend, and Michigan, MSU, and some other schools just kind of hanging in there and overextending themselves. Is there an end to this cycle?
This cycle is called an arms race, and there's no end to it. There's no cap in sight because it's not based on marketplace. It's based on the alumni enthusiasm for winning, which has no limitation. Now, to be clear, Michigan and Ohio State are right there together. Michigan is one of the biggest spenders in college football. State is pretty close. There's also a big division between the SEC, the Southeastern Conference, the Big Ten, and all the others, and it's based on TV. So the money is insane, and it's getting insaner, if you will. And look, I can make a marketplace argument for this, but I can also tell you that if you're a lecturer one at Michigan, you get about $10,000 a semester. At some point, what do we care about? You have to ask that question.
Forgive me for inserting my Buckeye perspective in the financial analysis there, but John,
she's been outed, by the way, on that one.
John Ubakin, thanks for coming in.
Thank you, April.
The question of how the MSU Board of Trustees handled the hiring of D'Antonio's replacement is the subject of Daniel Howe's latest column for the Detroit News, a situation he says demonstrates fallibility of elected bodies of trustees. Daniel, welcome back to Stateside.
Thanks for having me.
So the issue is not so much the chosen candidate, but maybe how the process worked.
Yeah, I mean, I think ultimately we'll find out. We'll find out if he's the right guy. I think they wanted someone who was younger, who could have some staying power. You know, you don't want to be doing this every 2 or 3 years, certainly, because you can't build a program that way. You need consistency. But I have been focused on the governance of the big three universities in Michigan. We are the only state in the United States that elects the trustees for its big three universities on statewide partisan at-large ballots. It becomes a very political process. I've talked to people in both parties, and they tell me how it happens at convention time. It is not the way to pick leadership and governors of multi-billion dollar institutions funded by the taxpayers.
You go into this a bit in the column about there being a big difference between management and governance. And the fact that a trustee was, you know, pretty, it appears to be the point person in this whole deal. Can you say a little bit more about what's wrong with that approach? I mean, why that's a problem to have the AD, you know, in the backseat of the car?
If you have management, let them manage. And I think one of the things that I see going on a lot at these universities, I used to see it a lot at Detroit City Council, to be frank, were council members that didn't understand the difference between governance and management. And they were constantly trying to manage the business of the city. And I think you have the same thing in the context of the university. It's important to note that a lot of these people who do get these jobs and are elected on these ballots, a lot of them, very few of them, I've looked at these and do not have corporate experience. They don't come out of the corporate world. They're not selected or recruited for their expertise in finance, law, business management. They just happen to be friendly with people in the party, and therefore they get put up and they run. If you look at the pedigree and the background of some of these people, these are not the kind of people that you would put on the board of a multi-billion dollar corporation.
Can you think of any immediate examples of how the process should work?
I mentioned in the piece how Michigan Jim Hackett, when he was interim AD there, and he went out to hire went after, I guess is the best way to put it, Jim Harbaugh when he was at the San Francisco 49ers. I think Hackett made it very clear that he did not want big donor involvement. He was going to be the person that would run the process. Of course, he worked with some consultants. That's kind of commonplace. And Michigan State worked with some consultants. But, you know, you're supposed to let the athletic director do the job without a lot of interference. And I think there may not have been actual interference at Michigan State, but I think when you had a board member kicking up some, making headlines and then dismissing the first candidate as a flake, a waffling flake, to be precise, that doesn't speak very well about the university in terms of how they go about the process by denigrating someone who is considered to be one of the up-and-comers coaches in the country.
This Michigan State University board has faced numerous problems. What's the way forward at this point, given that the governance structure isn't changing anytime soon?
Yeah, that's right. It would pay you. You'd have to amend the state constitution, and I don't think that's going to happen. You know, I don't know. I know that Governor Snyder, when I believe it was George Perlis, stepped aside and left early, he decided to put in Nancy Schlichting, who is a former CEO of Henry Ford Health System, and someone I've known for years, and is a real pro, very smart, a good executive, also on the board of Duke. She lasted less than a year there. And I think part of it was a frustration of a CEO who comes in there and kind of looks at the dysfunction of the board, makes her recommendations. Of course, the majority of people kind of ignored her recommendations. And she's like, you know, I don't need to do this anymore. And she quit. She was the kind of person that I think, personally, you need to salt these boards with. You don't need them all to be corporate types, but it's certainly important to have some people who have boardroom experience dealing with very complex, large organizations that are public-facing. And that is clearly a school like Michigan State, or Michigan, or Wayne State, for that matter. And by the way, we haven't talked about it, but there's this ongoing Donnybrook right now at Wayne State, which is very similar. And the board is fighting with itself. It's factionalized. One side wants to fire the president. The other side doesn't. They've got one or two more votes, so he stays on. And it's like a clown show every time they have a meeting. And you're like, what is going on here?
Yeah.
I mean, and this is endemic, and that's why I keep pointing some of this stuff out, because I think this is an issue. We are unique as a state, and I don't think we're getting, and I think a lot of people, based on my incoming email, I don't think a lot of people think we're getting what we ought to get for institutions that have such great reputations nationally and even internationally.
Daniel House is a columnist and associate business editor at the Detroit News. Daniel, good talking to you again.
Thanks talking to you.
After the break, we'll speak with Michigan State University trustee Diane Byram for her perspective on how the hiring's received. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside. I'm April Baer. As you heard before the break, Michigan State University has hired Mel Tucker as its new head football coach. Coach Mark D'Antonio retired earlier this month, leaving MSU with few options at a critical point in the calendar. Mel Tucker has ties to Michigan State, where he was on Nick Saban's coaching staff 2 decades ago. He's worked for several other programs since then. It's the price tag that got a lot of people's attention. According to a published report from The Athletic, Tucker will double the salary he received at his current job in Colorado, more than $5 million per year at MSU on a 6-year contract. As you also heard, many observers have had questions about whether this was the right move at the right time for MSU and the nature of the hiring process. We asked Diane Byram, one of MSU's trustees, to join us, and she agreed to do so. Diane Byram, welcome back to Stateside.
Thank you very much.
Can you tell us a little bit why the university put together this package? I think all told, the compensation's close to $30 million to hire Mel Tucker.
Well, obviously, Michigan State University was looking for a new head coach. We're in a very competitive coaching market in terms of the Big Ten. And so our package is competitive with the Big Ten coaches. Nothing out of the ordinary there. What I really want to focus on, though, is that we had a successful search. It was at warp speed, but with Mel Tucker as our new head coach for the football program at Michigan State University, he's absolutely the right person at the right time for the program.
At the same time, he is a second choice candidate and a candidate who had already said no, publicly stating he was going to stay in Colorado and then who came around after receiving what he called an offer that was impossible to ignore. He's a guy with only 1 year under his belt as a head coach, and while he is respected and has some MSU history, he only had a 5-7 record last season.
Well, this is a celebration of an outstanding, top-tier head coach for Michigan State University football program. I will not subscribe to a discussion or a description that Mel Tucker is anything but a top-tier football coach. He's had extensive experience not only under Nick Saban, but also under Jim Tressel at Ohio State. He does have roots starting back at Michigan State University as a graduate assistant. And so it was Michigan State welcoming back a family member. And we are very excited about having him here. And we're very excited about the future of Spartan football.
You know, a number of columnists who wrote about this hire had searing criticisms for the timing of this. The NCAA's president, Mark Emmert, was just in Washington, D.C., pleading with senators to head off several states' plans for allowing compensation for athletes. How could anyone look at this compensation package and believe that universities can't afford to pay something for their players?
We're talking about the head coach position for the football team. There are separate conversations going about in some 30 states as well as federally on how you handle compensation for student athletes. And I do believe that is a conversation that needs to happen in the halls of Congress and have a single standard that everyone knows the ground rules on. But that's a separate issue from hiring a head coach for a football program in East Lansing, Michigan.
Regardless of whether MSU can afford to pay its players, so I'm happy to put that aside for the moment, can MSU afford to hire Coach Tucker? The university has paid out $498 million to victims of Larry Nassar, and there are still 20 cases left. Negotiations over those cases may not be done yet.
First of all, the general fund budget of the university and student tuition dollars are not the same dollars that are used to fund the athletic program. The athletic program stands alone with its enterprise and its revenues, and it's self-sustaining. So you can't equate the university's financial picture and student dollars and state tax dollars with the running of the athletic department. They're separate budgets. They're funded separately.
Where has the new president been amid this hiring process?
Well, President Stanley was involved to the extent that he was supporting the athletic director, Bill Beekman. It is the role of the athletic director with his team to identify, vet the coach, and then bring forward their recommendation for board action. Now, having said that, he did have the support and the counsel of President Stanley, but it is the athletic director who should be front and center. It should not be the president, and it should not be the board of trustees. And in this case, it was the athletic director. We trust Bill Beekman as our athletic director to conduct a search and bring forward an outstanding candidate. And in that measure, he was absolutely successful with our hiring of Mel Tucker as our next football coach.
Should fans be concerned to see the comments of the public comments of one trustee very prominently questioning whether a waffling candidate is the right one? That the trustees are indeed driving this process and not Athletic Director Beekman?
Well, I can assure you the trustees were not driving this process. The trustees were informed and kept abreast of what was going on through the athletic director. The trustees were not reaching out to candidates. The trustees were not traveling with the athletic department for interviews. The trustees were kept informed, but this was a search that the athletic director and his team at MSU Athletics conducted.
You know, reports stated that Michigan State's first choice, Luke Fickell in Cincinnati, turned the job down because he felt that the cultural issues around MSU right now were just not something that he wanted to deal with. Does that raise any red flags for you about what should be happening in the governance of the university?
Michigan State University just successfully landed its 25th head football coach. That is something to celebrate in Mel Tucker. Does the university have challenges? Absolutely, as do universities across this state and this nation. And it's always a work in process, but it has the priority of the Board of Trustees and the president to make sure that we have a more welcoming, safe, and inclusive culture at Michigan State. We are embarking on a strategic planning process across the university that is, we've already started. We're also embarking on diversity, equity, and inclusion. So we're very specific and we're very determined in how we approach those issues of DEI so that we can make a significant difference in the culture at Michigan State. But again, these issues are ongoing across all college campuses. Today, being a trustee at any public university is a very difficult job, and it's not for someone of the faint of heart because you have to make tough decisions. You're faced with very difficult issues on a daily basis. And at Michigan State, we're 50,000 students, 20,000 faculty. We have students from every county in this state. And we have students from across the United States and across the globe. So it is a very difficult job, and it's something that we take our pride in. And at Michigan State, we feel that we have a top-notch program, and students want to come to this university, and we are graduating successful students that go on to have great careers and make a difference in the world.
You know, to that end, we were talking earlier today with Daniel House, a columnist for the Detroit News, and he observed that he really sees endemic issues with the oversight of our biggest three universities in Michigan by elected trustees. You know, no question what you're saying. This is a very difficult job governing very big schools, but he was saying that he just thinks the system is not delivering what residents and students need. And for the record, he was not just talking about MSU. Do you think Michigan is getting the best governance possible out of the system we now have?
I believe you can make the argument for elected boards of trustees for the three research universities, which is what the Michigan Constitution provides, because we have a much bigger and broader mission than some of the more regional colleges in this state that are appointed by the governor. And so I do think that you do get more diversity and who's sitting on those boards than you might otherwise get with a gubernatorial appointment that can have even some political dynamics at that point. I want to draw attention to the fact that Michigan State University landed a new president, our 21st president, in Samuel Stanley. And he's been on the job for a little over 6 months. And that was a very successful search with a top quality candidate that is the top caliber across the United States. So I think the future at Michigan State University is very bright, and we are on a good trajectory, both in terms of having a new president and Dr. Stanley, but also with the athletic program, with this new hire of Coach Mel Tucker, to complement what we already have as outstanding coaches across our athletic program.
Diane Byram, thank you for your time today. We really appreciate your speaking with us.
Thank you.
Diane Byram is a trustee of Michigan State University. If you've got bees in your bonnet about college sports, college administration, or really anything that you hear us talking about, we love hearing from you. You can always drop comments on the Michigan Radio Facebook page. Feel free to reach out on Twitter if that's easier, at Stateside Radio. We're always looking for your story ideas, and we do appreciate the feedback. All the pats on the back, all the tossed tomatoes, seriously, we love hearing from you. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Governor Gretchen Whitmer's pick for an influential state board has run into opposition. Republican leaders in the legislature have rejected Professor Anna Mitterling's nomination to the Michigan Natural Resources Commission. State Senator Curtis Hertel, Democrat from East Lansing, was among those incensed by the move.
Colleagues, quite frankly, most of you would be lucky to have a resume like this. Thank God for each of you that no one had to review your resume in this same way, whether you had to serve in this body. She is obviously qualified.
But as with many things at the state's capital, there's more going on here than wildlife policy. Our Capitol Bureau Chief Rick Pluta joins us now with more. Rick, good to see you.
Nice to see you, too.
Help me out here. What does the commission do?
The Natural Resources Commission is actually a pretty consequential body that it is supposed to promote hunting and fishing and outdoors activities. It regulates hunting and fishing seasons. It sets fees for hunting and fishing licenses. And it's really one of the plum appointments if you operate in that outdoors realm.
Right. So I'm just looking over Anna Mitterling's resume here. Mm-hmm. She's a biology professor at Lansing Community College, and she does work for the Michigan Wildlife Cooperative, which is a partnership of several different groups. And for the record, she is an independent in terms of her party affiliation.
Mm-hmm. Well, and it's the way that these appointments work is that one party will get a certain number of appointments, the other party will get a certain number of appointments, but it's not unusual for they're supposed to be designated unaffiliated appointments, and that is where Professor Mitterling fits in on the Natural Resources Commission, or would have had her appointment been confirmed.
Hey, Rick, isn't there another nomination to the commission pending already?
Well, right, you are. There is another nomination to the commission pending, and that appointment is really what's at the center of all of this, and that is former Grand Rapids Mayor George Hartwell.
So why are Republicans putting their foot down on this?
Well, because George Hartwell is, even though, again, officially unaffiliated as the mayor of Grand Rapids, that he is part of the group Mayors Against Gun Violence, that he's a supporter of Mike Bloomberg for president, who's made gun violence a big issue. And so there are people, the NRA in particular, that are, you know, sensing whiffs of what they would call anti-gun sentiments.
Right. How often do we see these kind of nomination fights coming up?
Not very often. The last one that we've really seen like this, you'd have to go back to the governor before the last one, Jennifer Granholm, before we saw the Senate reject an appointment.
Rick, this is starting to sound a little bit like road funding. Obviously, Governor Whitmer and Republican leaders in the legislature, including Mike Shirkey and Lee Chatfield, have been at odds with the governor over road funding issues, and that really set the tone for the budget discussion last year. Now this nomination block. Do you think this is the tone we can expect to see between the governor and the leadership and the legislative leadership through 2020?
This is clearly another example of the legislative branch, the state Senate in this instance, asserting its prerogatives and letting the governor know, the Democratic governor know, that they are going to build walls around her authority and her ability to get done the things that she wants to get done.
Rick, have we heard anything from the governor's office about this?
We have. We got this statement from the governor's press secretary, Tiffany Brown.
These are the kinds of partisan games Pete Lucido and the Republican caucus are playing. Now they're threatening to reject a qualified woman who has dedicated her career to wildlife conservation because they didn't get what they want.
Senator Pete Lucido, what does he have to do with this?
He's back. Senator Lucido chairs the Senate Advice and Consent Committee. And you will remember, those of you playing along at home, that Senator Lucido is also the one who's been accused by another state senator, Mallory Morrow, a Democrat, of making sexist comments to her.
So if we're just reading the semiotics here, there's probably a reason why that name got brought up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would say that there is a perception game at play here as well.
Did you get a chance to talk to any Republicans about how far they plan to take this?
Well, Senator Shirky in a post-session scrum said that the issue here is, I mean, it was acknowledged the issue here is that the administration does not talk often enough with the Senate about these kinds of appointments, and that this may not be the last time we see something like this.
So it's not unusual to negotiate and compromise and try to find a middle ground, which is what we tried to do. Our governor decided not to compromise, so that's the bottom line.
There you have it.
So I'm trying to just parse this out here as a newcomer to all things Lansing. Is what we're seeing here both sides trying to get each other to the table in a certain way, or do you foresee this being an actual standoff based on, you know, the issues that may inform what they want out of the commission?
That we have two branches of government, each of them controlled by a different party and different personalities that are asserting their authority and trying to do the best they can to control these situations when both sides are in the position to force a stalemate, but not a victory.
Rick, thanks very much for giving us the briefing on this.
Pleasure as always.
That's our Capitol Bureau Chief, Rick Pluta. Special thanks to Max Johnson of Interlochen Public Radio for the extra help and hustle producing the story. Coming up, contemporary artists capturing Black life through portraiture.
Capturing things that move me personally, and sometimes even like simple things, you know, simple like just gestures, trying to capture just those moments and trying to freeze time in a moment that I feel that is authentic.
That's next on Stateside. You're listening to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Whether your main interaction with art is a museum in your town or just stuff that you see on Instagram, you may be aware how images of Black faces and Black bodies have changed over the years. It's simply more common to see things like TV and online ads reflecting a diversity that's closer to the U.S. population. And in the art world, there's more space for works by and featuring women and men of color, including memorable and explosive portraits by Kehinde Wiley, Amy Sherald, Carrie James Marshall, and many others. Today, we invited two artists living and working in Detroit to talk about portraiture. Sydney James is a fine artist and muralist with a background in commercial art. Her work is seen around Detroit, L.A., Atlanta, and elsewhere. Justin Milhouse is a photographer and filmmaker with a full commercial and sports portfolio, in addition to his artwork. I met up with both of them at the Detroit Institute of Art's Cressy Court. Sydney James and Justin Milhouse, welcome to Stateside.
Hello.
Thank you. How are you doing?
We are delighted to meet you. Can I just ask you for starters to think about either a photograph or a portrait of any media that really knocked you for a loop at some point?
I remember like 4 years ago, I was doing a shoot with a document in Detroit, and I was... my project was documenting the Nation of Islam in Detroit, and it wasn't just one photo, but the series of photos when I went to their house to take photos of just them getting ready, everyday life. I met, I forget the guy's name, but the member of Nation of Islam, him and his family, they actually live like two blocks down from where I grew up. So I went over there and just got photos, and that whole just experience and just being just in their home and them just inviting me and just seeing their everyday life and just, you know, shining light on maybe, you know, shining light through my photography of a situation that, you know, maybe everybody doesn't see. I thought that was just cool for me. So.
Do you feel like it was difficult to communicate the intensity of that moment in the portraits you took?
I don't think it was difficult because I felt like it was authentic and it just was organic. We talked before I didn't just go in taking photos. Like we talked, we had conversations, and when I started shooting, it was just kind of just natural. Everybody felt natural. So I don't feel like it was difficult because it came from an organic place. And something I was truly interested in capturing. So I don't think it was that particular time wasn't difficult. So.
Sydney, what about you? What comes to mind when you think about a knockout portrait, either that you saw or that you made yourself?
I would have to say the very first time I experienced Barclay Hendrick's work. He had a solo exhibit out at the Santa Monica Museum while I was living out in L.A. And probably every portrait there, just because, and I believe it was the Birth of Cool body of work, just because they look like gods because of the how massive the paintings were, but they also were regular people, regular black people. Like, it could, you might feel like he was a pimp, or you might feel like she was a woman of the night, or a woman of church, or a man of whatever, but these were like just wonderfully painted black people. And because typically when you think of black art, you think of like the Harlem Renaissance. Well, most people, the average person.
Jacob Lawrence.
Yeah, like that, those very abstracted like collages and stuff. I'm not really attracted to that. But when I saw his work, I was, and it was created around like just after that time period, but during at the same time, I was like, oh, this is what it's about. Like controlling all of our images, because we, as we know, images have way more power than even words.
What was the point at which you started to recognize your own capacity, or like that you were, you would be able to create that sense of agency for your subjects in your own work?
When I started painting murals in 2014, because then I it's the act of painting publicly. That's one thing, because you get a many unintentional viewers, whereas we're sitting in a museum right now, these are intentional viewers. So many of the viewership, they don't look like us.
Even if it's a free day, it's a select crowd that's
exactly,
going to see this.
Exactly, because art is for the elite, quote unquote. We, like, it's not like a direct lesson, but that's kind of how, like, especially like inner city or poor kid, rural kids, that's how they feel. They're not exposed to it. But if I could paint massively how I paint, which is a fine art type way of painting, for the world to see, like, I control the narrative. I control our narratives, you know? So I think that's when I knew for sure, like, the power of images and portraiture, like, especially large, on a large scale.
And Sydney, your work is obviously very, especially on the wall-sized murals, but I think also in the drawings, too. It's realistic. You're not sparing with your subjects, but you're also pouring on the love.
Yeah.
And whether it's the sheen on someone's skin or warmth or a sense of command in their eyes, it's all there. And like a lot of the physical postures that you show people in are, they say, look at what I'm showing you right now. This is what, you know, it's just really head-on kind of stuff. Was there an evolution with how you came to communicate power in that way?
Yeah, there was. Like, so I started this series called Appropriated, Not Appreciated, speaking on the state of black women, really stem from what's been happening in this country, but it's been happening worldwide. Like,
you mean since 2013 with Black Lives Matter?
About Black Lives Matter, but really, like, when, because I think Black Lives Matter stem from, like, black men being brutalized by the police. But we rarely see or hear of the black women that are also going through the same thing with the police. And that's really what created that entire series. Like, but I started even painting us how I felt we were being treated. Like, I painted myself nude and put it on the floor as a doormat, right? But then the more I thought about it, it's like, no. I don't need to portray the images of how you think that people are behaving towards you. Show them how you want to be treated. And, you know, so if we always say peace queen, hey queen, show us as queens. Show us in a grander light how you want people to, and you might see like the struggle behind their eyes or in their skin texture. But if I paint you boldly enough, you can see that we're still strong, even though those things, you know.
Justin, your work has a cooler temperature and, you know, smoother values, but at the same time, your photographs are just packed with narrative and character in it, just a really different way. It's easy to look at, you know, a picture of a young man or woman that you may have photographed glancing to the side and they're smiling about something and just wonder what, you know, what was going on in that moment, and to, you know, imagine the threads of their life, or, you know, like capturing what's going on in the game story for a game that you might be shooting. How did you start to think about, again, about those themes of agency and bringing people's images forward in a stronger way?
I think a lot of it for me was just capturing things that move me personally. And sometimes even like simple things, you know, simple like just gestures, trying to capture just those moments and trying to freeze time in a moment that I feel that is authentic. I feel like with my studio work, I like a technique I really like is like the one light just on the subject. And just moving that one light and that spotlight and, you know.
There's a dark background and and the subject just seems to emerge very luminous out of the void.
Yeah, so I like that because it's almost like,
They feel like paintings.
Yeah, yeah. So we were shooting, we shot a couple of days ago. And when me and Sydney were talking, she was asking me, did you used to draw? Because you shoot like you draw.
Like a painter.
I said I did. I used to, but just it took too long to really
Come
for
to
me.
Out
for
his
me.
Granddaddy is a painter.
Yeah, my granddad
and
is a photographer and painter. But I say that to say, so with the photography and just that one light technique, I feel like if I can get. Because all you need is, like, one shot. And if you can really, you know, have the subject, you know, connect with you through the camera, I feel like that's how you can tell the story. And usually when I, you know, when talking about the studio photography, usually when I do these shoots, I like to talk to the person for a little bit. We set up. We have a, you know, want to get to know them. So, you know, it's an authentic, you know, time.
Put a collaborative element in there.
Yes.
This is such a funny moment for portraiture in the macro sense. Major brands are employing black faces and black bodies to communicate things about, you know, how they want people to feel about their story. And yet sometimes the images feel like a version of white life. With an African American being dropped into it, or functioning as a side player, you know, like in a best friend kind of role.
Right.
How do you put your subjects, how do you center your subjects in the stories you tell with your work?
Because our use of the subjects are intentional, not just like an afterthought, like, oh, I have to include diversity. Oh, we have to hit this quota for diversity. So just bring, you know, Hakeem in here so we could put him in this, you know, H&M sweater, like, so we could fulfill this quota. So I feel like the intent is different, and that's why it feels more genuine, because it is more genuine. I'm not fetishizing black women, because oftentimes, like, plenty of white people do paint black people, black women. But are we subjects or are we people? And I feel like you can feel the difference between somebody, their intent behind it, like a Kehinde Wiley versus somebody else that might not be a part of the culture painting us. We might be painted very well. We might look very stoic, but we look like things. We feel like things in those great paintings, not necessarily humans.
I would like to ask you a question that I was talking to Valerie about too. Black identity has by necessity meant a lot of different things over the years in terms of what is shown within the community and what can safely be expressed in a wider white world. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, do we always have to look at work by black artists through multiple lenses in that way?
We don't have to, but I think people choose to. Because I feel like we're always under a microscope. Whether it's be like, I feel like especially either one of us, because we weren't intending to be necessarily influencers, as they call it now. We just really started out doing what we love. And when you're good at something, people want more of it. But now, because we might have to behave a certain way in the public, like now we represent the whole culture, but the culture is not monolithic. It's a whole bunch of stuff. Although, like, most images that are shown of us overseas are violent, or, you know, us in despair. and it's not very positive most of the time. And if it is positive, it's like extreme, like you got to be Barack Obama.
But, and that's it. And that's,
but the in-between is not celebrated or shown. So people only know the extreme or the extreme. So they don't know what to think of this culture. But this culture is so vast. It's so great. And it depends on where you're from, because you could be Southern. It's like you could be Southern. That's a different type of black. You know,
West Coast.
East Side, West Side.
Yeah, that's
just the Detroit.
Right.
Those are different type of. It depends. They, you know, but one thing is one thing is true of all of these things. We're even regal in our despair. And that's what I like to portray in my work. Like, yes, you might see this person down and out. Although I don't, I really don't paint like homeless people and stuff. That's not my thing. But if I did, it would be in such a way that you would feel like she was a god anyway.
Justin, you recently did a portrait of your mom, who's a district court judge.
Yes.
I should say, you've also photographed your grandparents recently, but I'm not going to talk about that because I'm going to start crying. Those pictures were so sweet and so beautiful. But this one of your mom, it feels like it was kind of indicative of what we're talking about. Could you describe the picture? It was just that one on Instagram the other day.
Yeah, the one. My mom has been a judge for 20 years in the city of Detroit. And the day we did the portrait, it was the day she was elected was in office. And so I was like, Mom, you know, let's get a photo. Like, let's use your black robe. We're going to do a black background. And she had, like, these earrings and this necklace that I like, too. I said, let's, put that on. But, like, the one light technique, I want that light to, like, shine on you. And at first, I had her looking up, but I was like, no, look down and smile. Like, you just, you know, just like a authentic, you know. Like.
And it helps that your mother has a 1,000-watt smile.
Man.
Yeah.
I saw that picture like, I want to look like this when you shoot me.
It's breathtaking.
Yeah. And I wanted just really her smile and even what she was wearing and even the cloth she had.
She's wearing this sash. Calls back to African textiles.
Yes, yes. I wanted all that to kind of like be in the forefront of the photo, and that's why with that one light technique, and that's why with the all black, you know, I just wanted it to be like she's just emerging from this this greatness. So I'm proud of my mom. I'm proud of everything she's done. She's always been supportive of everything that I've done. So you know, that was kind of my thank you to her. So.
Do you think she is able to see herself in that way?
I believe so. I think so. And what do you mean, though, as far as...
In the photo, she looks very gracious, and you can see intelligence written all over her face. And I just wondered if she had ever been photographed in quite that way before. With your knowledge of all her work and all her warmth.
I think this might be the first time, and I think it's special because I'm her son also. I just feel like that photo, for me, just really speaks to her humility and her kindness and her fairness that she portrays. And she's always portrayed, you know, to me. She's always told me to, you know, do the right thing and always be humble. And I've taken those values with everything I've done too. So, man, that photo, yeah.
Man, that photo is everything.
Yeah.
It is.
Sydney James and Justin Milhouse, thank you so much for all your work and for talking to us today.
Yes.
Support for arts and cultural coverage on Stateside comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs. Tomorrow on the show, we're going to speak with a photographer, artist, and curator whose work focuses on blackness, queerness, and intersectional identities.
I'm having conversations about this intersectionality of what it means to be black and queer. I'm having conversations about what it means to be a black male-bodied person who is feminine, who exists within his feminine energy.
Daryl D'Angelo Terrell is our guest. I hope you can be here, or just sign up for the podcast and you can check it out when it drops. That's our show for today. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm April Baer. Thanks for listening. We'll see you tomorrow.